Good morning, welcome to Prairie Society. I'm Rick Racking, the current president. Our program today is on the anniversary of the 40th anniversary of the United Nations, celebrated this past week. Pat Cotley will be giving the program. I'd also like to mention that in Madison this week we've had a 100th centennial anniversary of the Channing Murray program, a campus youth organization for Unitarian Universalist youth who care to continue with their studies, their growing ethical awareness. And so with that, I'll light the candle this morning and we'll start our program.
You heard the first part of Las Mañanitas, the Mexican birthday song, which seemed particularly appropriate, and the ethnic connection will play the second part of Las Mañanitas.
This is in celebration of the 40th birthday of the United Nations. Mexican birthday song, Las Mañanitas.
Some of you may have heard the remarks made by the presidents and heads of state this week at the United Nations about how it had fallen short of our hopes and expectations. That may well be true, but it still is the one organization that has some promise for worldwide cooperation. I attended a very interesting workshop all day at the university on the nuclear problem, what can we do about it. A Norwegian was there, and he said, you know, in Europe, where I come from, we think of the world as composed of 160 nations, but here in this country, you talk as if there are only two. And that brought home to us our way of thinking. Let's sing a song, If I Were Free, on page 28 of the songbook. Shall we stand?
Thank you.
And now, in recognition of the importance of Russia, the ethnic connection, we'll play a Russian song, Moscow Nights. As you already know, today we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations. A few of you are old enough to remember the time in June 1945, before World War II had ended in the Pacific, when 51 nations gathered in San Francisco to consider this and work out a charter, which then had to be ratified by all of the five permanent members of the Security Council and a majority of all the others. And it took until October 24th that same year for that ratification to take place, which is the reason we consider October 24th the founding of the United Nations. But actually, the meeting in that June was extremely exciting, and I asked several Prairie people who remembered it distinctly to tell us a little about their feelings. Unfortunately, Lee Bowen isn't here because Alice is ill, but John Grindrod is. Both John and Lee were conscientious objectors at the time. John, would you tell us a little about your memories?
I don't remember that the event per se made an earth-shaking impression, but I was somewhat skeptical in those days as I am now, I guess. And I thought it was a marvelous step, but it seemed to me that as the events at the end of the war developed, that it was that it failed to attack certain fundamentals. And one was national sovereignty. The UN has at least officially been committed to the idea that nations have sovereignty and are a law unto themselves. And I would have liked to see some statement that nations are not totally sovereign, as indeed they're not. They're limited by what other nations do. And also, I became a bit cynical because it seemed as though it was a club for winners rather than losers, and that intended to keep the military advantages that it had gained and the territorial arrangements that were a result of the war, and rather than having a the colonies are, I suppose, a crowning example. Nobody was about to give up any of their colonial privileges. Still, it was certainly a step in the direction world opinion being considered. I think that of course, I guess the veto power came later.
No, it was agreed on then.
That was certainly something disillusioning as well. But still, I'm all for it. May it have more power, even though I'm
Thank you. Well, I remember very clearly listening over the radio to the speeches in San Francisco in June and really feeling very thrilled that the nations were trying to work out a better arrangement than the League of Nations had been. And I don't think there's any doubt but that the United Nations is far superior to the League of Nations. But at the same time, we were disappointed at the time that the United States and Russia were the two powers that insisted on the veto power within the Security Council. The five permanent members of the Security Council were the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, and China, mainland China, with Chiang Kai-shek's China, which had fought against the Japanese. Anyway, we hugged each other and had great hopes for the future, and at least the United Nations is still in existence, and it's almost impossible to imagine its disappearing. For one thing, there are 17 agencies that provide very important functions to many, many countries, which are essential, really, to the life of many countries, and those agencies are not going to disappear. Even though our government last summer, as some of you may be aware, through the Senate, through Nancy Kassenbaum's efforts, although she has been a pretty good person to vote in support of many international issues, as we would like a senator to vote, she became quite outraged at the fact that the Assistant Secretary General, a man from Canada, who has been very active and a very fine negotiator over the years, was ready to retire, and to persuade him to stay on, they decided to give him the amount of money, most of which he had contributed to the retirement system. It amounted to something like $300,000, and she was outraged because of giving anyone that sort of salary, forgetting how much our industrial magnates earn every year. And I think that needs to be brought to her attention at some point. Yes?
How did you feel after being conscientious objector when you discovered the information that the Holocaust was taking place?
Of course, I was appalled by the who is an Englishman, who said, there are indeed worse things than war, and war brings all of them. That is to say, this took place in wartime.
No, I understand. I understand the history of 9/11. Thank you.
You all have a sheet near you where you're sitting, the preamble to the Charter of the United Nations. Let's stand and read it together. We, the people of the United Nations, determine the succeeding generations from the scourge of war,
which twice in our lifetime
has brought untold sorrow to mankind,
and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small,
and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, and for these ends to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security, and to ensure by the acceptance of principles and the institution of methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims. Accordingly, our respective governments, through representatives assembled in the city of San Francisco, who have exhibited their full powers found to be in good and due form, have agreed to the present Charter of the United Nations, and do hereby establish an international organization to be known as the United Nations. Well, how well has the UN done? First, just a brief word about the setup. I've mentioned the Security Council, and any of the five permanent members on the Security Council, and mainland China is back there after quite an interval of time, can exert the veto, which means that the Security Council cannot act as a council. A nation can also abstain from voting, which shows disapproval of whatever the action is, but does not interfere. And that was what the United States did recently when the Security Council condemned Israel for the bombing in Tunisia, which is interesting that that happens too. And then from 1940, then the General Assembly is a larger group consisting of a representative, a voting representative, of each nation that is a member. The United Nations started out with 51 members. It's grown to 159. And in this 40-year period, most of the additional 100, about 80 of them, are relatively poor, developing countries that became free from colonial domination. So you can imagine, really, there have been tremendous changes in our world since 1945 because of the development of all of these other nations. So the spirit in the General Assembly has changed. Many of the nations are critical of what some of the larger countries are doing. There are blocks there. And a little later, I'll mention a proposal that has come up for changing the voting structure somewhat in the General Assembly and in the whole United Nations. In addition, then, there is a large group of non-governmental organizations, of which the UUA is one, which are accepted to membership after they apply and indicate that they have genuine concern about international relations. they are invited to a great many of the conferences, especially those held by the Economic and Social Council, which is especially concerned about the economic and social condition in the countries. They may make statements and recommendations and do provide a very important source of input to the United Nations. Probably the, yes?
Do you know about how many such organizations there are? Is there only one representative at a time?
Well, one representative is in the General Assembly. That's 159 nations at present. The non-governmental don't have a single representative, as far as I know. Is that your understanding, Les? I mean, they receive announcements. Actually, the organization I work for is an NGO, and we receive a great many announcements of conferences and invitations to attend. But since it's a non-voting group, it is not limited. In fact, we have three accredited representatives in New York to attend the meetings there, one in Geneva and one in Vienna. But Amnesty International is probably the best known of all the NGOs, and it has had a great impact on working to free political prisoners over the years, although it's not been completely successful either. Some of the accomplishments of member agencies of the UN, just to mention a few, you've probably heard that the World Health Organization has eliminated smallpox from the earth, which really is a major accomplishment when you think of the health conditions in these undeveloped countries. It has worked hard to eliminate malaria and seemed to be getting ahead of malaria when the mosquitoes developed resistance to DDT. So they're back again having to fight malaria, which is one of the great scourges of the tropical countries. There have been many grassroots accomplishments. Any nation can request technical help. Pakistan needed help with their inland canals, which were very important for transportation. A Finnish expert came to help them, and there is a great deal going on that we never hear about in the newspaper, special help to individual countries. And of course, UNICEF, you're all familiar with. UNICEF has had, many important campaigns, but two of the most important have been against a disease or a condition called yaws, which is an ulcerous condition that children get very frequently in hot, humid weather. One dose of penicillin will cure yaws. It's also had a wide campaign against tuberculosis. Since some of you may not have an opportunity to contribute to UNICEF on Halloween night, I'm going to pass this larger carton today to see if we can partially fill it up for UNICEF, which does provide many, many services. Yes, Orange?
Another thing that the local UNICEF committee has talked about as being very exciting and relevant for UNICEF, and that is called ORT, is oral rehydration therapy. And in many countries where famine is a problem, most of the children actually die from diarrhea. Their bodies become so dehydrated that they can't really accept food. It's not actually undernourishment that kills them. And there's a very important breakthrough in providing a small packet of oral rehydration therapy salts and things, which has made a huge impact so far and is very inexpensive. So UNICEF's money is going even further than it used to by buying this particular therapy. Especially the countries where malnutrition is a killer.
Oh, thank you, Orange. And any of you who want to interrupt, please do so. That's very good to call that to our attention. I don't know whether many of you remember the Berlin blockade in 1948 when Russia did not want to permit any communication between East Germany and West Germany. And the Security Council proposed various solutions, but of course the Soviet Union vetoed them. The United States had an airlift for getting supplies and food into Berlin. That was successful. But eventually this was resolved by the fact that the representatives of the four great powers involved could meet informally in the corridors of the UN and talk about possible solutions without benefit of the media. And I do think this is an important advantage. I think our media do us a great disservice at times by reporting every if, and but in international negotiation. And I do hope that at the Geneva meeting there will be some privacy before announcements are made. But during, this is well documented in the UN records, that if it hadn't been for the fact that the representatives of the countries were all there, were all concerned, no one wanted another war. It was much too soon after World War II had ended for anyone to want to fight again. But also, no country can really afford to lose face. And that is an extremely important consideration, I think, in every international confrontation. But these representatives could talk, sit in the lounge, and share ideas, and they did reach an agreement. Of course, it still maintained the division of East and West Germany. Our representative at that time was Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the first U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and served there for 8 years until President Eisenhower was elected. And somehow he did not want to reappoint her, unfortunately. She lived for 13 more years. And at the time of her death, Dag Hammarskjöld, who was then the Secretary General, eulogized Eleanor Roosevelt. It was the first time any non-governmental person had ever been eulogized in the United Nations, and everyone really mourned her. She was described by Adlai Stevenson at her death. He said, "She would rather light candles than curse the darkness, and her glow warmed the world. She saw clearly and she spoke simply. The power of her words came from the depth of her conviction. She was called the First Lady of the World." And I've asked Ruth Calden to read one of her statements.
"We must be willing to learn the lesson that cooperation may imply compromise, but if it brings a world advance, it is a gain for each individual nation. There will be those who doubt their ability to rise above those new heights, but the alternative is not possible to contemplate. We must build faith in the hearts of those who doubt, and we must rekindle faith in ourselves when it grows dim, and find some sort of divine courage within us to keep on till on earth we have peace and goodwill among all people."
Actually, I've put up a folder from the United Nations back where Les is sitting. You might be interested in looking at it afterwards. It enumerates many of the accomplishments of the United Nations over the years, and it's interesting to read them, even if you're not particularly interested in history. And over on this other wall, next to the yellow poster, is a map of the world showing the countries that belong to the United Nations and their relative population. After the first Secretary General, who was a Norwegian, Trygve Lie, who really was terribly disappointed that the nations began arguing with each other immediately, Dag Hammarskjöld, a Swede, was appointed, and he is really one of the heroes of the United Nations, I think. He showed remarkable ability as a negotiator. He had complete respect and honored the independent sovereignty of every country. He knew that that was extremely important, but yet he believed in talking about problems and seeking resolution of them. Probably not many of you remember the Suez Canal crisis in 1956, but at that time, Egypt had received a large shipment of arms from Czechoslovakia, which was under Russian influence and domination, and had stored them near the Israeli border. The Israelis became quite concerned, and after that action, the United States withdrew the offer of a loan to Egypt to build the Aswan Dam. You know, that dam was eventually built with Russian money, not with ours, although we were originally interested in it. Actually, it turned out to be a great monstrosity, it seems, but at that time it seemed very important to Egypt. And Egypt was enraged by this and reacted by seizing the Suez Canal and closing it. And if you remember your geography, it's an extremely important passage that enables ships to get from the Pacific and the Indian Ocean up to the Mediterranean without going all the way around Africa. Britain and France were especially concerned. The stockholders of the canal tried to negotiate, but without any success. And then Israel invaded Egypt, charging that Egypt was building up in order to destroy them. Well, Britain and France didn't want the canal damaged. They knew what a horrendous event that would be, so they asked the countries, please don't fight within 10 miles of the canal. But that didn't work. Egypt refused any negotiation. The U.S. offered a resolution for a ceasefire, which Britain and France both vetoed. They were in the Security Council, and their planes began bombing military targets in Egypt. And you can imagine, Russia was all ready to come in to give aid to Egypt, and the United States was asked by Britain and France to support them, but President Eisenhower, we have to give him real credit for this, said no, we'll go to the UN again. He said it should be called into action first. So the Security Council called the General Assembly into emergency session. They urged a ceasefire, and Britain and France agreed if the United Nations Emergency Peace Force could be sent in. Well, obviously, Egypt had to agree to this. Dag Hammarskjöld flew to Cairo. He was important. He saw how important it could be to use this force and to stop the fighting, but also that Egypt's consent had to be obtained. And first he got Egypt's permission to have a small group of 10 United Nations officers to go to Egypt. And the presence of these men, all with United Nations insignia, flags, armbands, and so on, had a remarkable psychological effect because anger seemed to be at a white heat then. And this was when Nasser was president, which makes it all the more remarkable, really, that this worked. But Hammarskjöld apparently had a very special ability to calm things, and also he completely believed in the use of this emergency force. So they had to persuade President Nasser to agree to the entrance of United Nations forces, which were being assembled in Italy already, because obviously it took time to get troops from 10 other different countries, none of them involved in the dispute at all. Nasser had many fears of the implications of this, but agreed. And within 10 days, troops were provided by 10 nations, Brazil, Finland, India, Yugoslavia, and so on. And even the civilian population treated these soldiers as friends. They called them soldiers of peace. That was probably the first important situation in which the United Nations Emergency Force was used. Egypt opened the canal. Of course, long lines of ships were waiting to go through, but this was a very satisfying event to every country and also to Egypt, which needed the fees paid. Then there was the Korean dispute, and maybe you, like me and many of us, think of it as primarily an American-Korean war. But actually, it was a war between the United Nations forces and the Koreans when North Korea invaded South Korea. Mike, are you saying, do you want to say something?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a United Nations dispute only because I think the United States at that time depended on a solid majority of the General Assembly to do whatever it wanted.
No, it was a United Nations dispute because Russia had withdrawn in pique from the Security Council because it had refused to seat a delegate from Communist China. So at this particular time, and there was no Russian representative meeting in the Security Council, so the Security Council could pass this. I mean, the General Assembly has never had power to go over the Security Council veto. They could make recommendations, and they undoubtedly supported this. But I think that's interesting, that if you pick up your toys and go home, something may happen in your absence that you don't like, because Russia would never have supported this action.
I think maybe Mike's point is well taken, though, that even if Russia had not been off the Security Council at that time, there was still a bit of free war.
Except,
take it to the General Assembly and ran it through. There was two-thirds support there for the United States on it. A Russian veto would have been meaningless. It would have been a United States-North Korean war, a United Nations-North Korean war, no matter what.
We can talk about that later. Actually, the authorities say that if the United Nations had not been able to take official action, which required the Security Council approval, the United Nations would have fallen apart, as the League of Nations did, the invasion of Ethiopia by Italy, for example. Now, who knows? We can't predict. Certainly, the force of world opinion is important and does have an effect, and we can hope that perhaps it would have become a United Nations war anyway. And then Dag Hammarskjöld also was Secretary General at the time the Republic of Congo in Central Africa attained independence from Belgium in 1960, and as you may know, the Congo, which is now the country of Zaire, is an extremely wealthy, rich country with deposits of many, many minerals that are widely used in all our industries, as well as uranium. And the Belgians had not trained any of the Congolese to take over the government, which the British did very well in India, for example. So Dag Hammarskjöld immediately saw that in this very rich, undeveloped country, there would be all sorts of international conflict. And Walter Lippmann, a political commentator at the time, said that no practical cure for this crisis could have been imagined without the UN, that we would have had to invent it if it hadn't existed at that time. It was dangerous there because there were advisors from Belgium and the USSR with partisans among the Congolese leaders, and some of you may even remember the name of Kasabavu and Lumumba and Chambi. Anyway, these sort of ring a faint bell in my memory. At one time, the richest province of all seceded, set up its own government, Katanga, and Dag Hammarskjöld sent Ralph Bunche from the United Nations, he was Assistant Secretary General at the time, to the independence celebrations and to arrange for a program of United Nations assistance. And during the next 2 years, the United Nations Development Council spent more money in the Congo training the people in all aspects of their government and life, training them to do the technical jobs that the Belgians had always managed, trained them in the processes of government, probably trained typists and accountants and so on, so that they could survive. Trained them in mining, set up schools, and so on. They nearly built a civilization from the ground up. Matthew?
For something like that.
The United Nations.
Where do they get the money?
Well, every country contributes proportionately according to its income. The United States contributes a fourth of the total budget, which is its share is $200 million. The Soviet Union contributes somewhat less. I'm not sure this is a current figure. I got it from a publication several years old, but the United States contributes $450 per capita to the United Nations, whereas Norway contributes $38 per capita to the United Nations.
Then the four countries that join, surely they don't contribute money.
They contribute very relatively little, yes. They all contribute something. And maybe I should mention this now because I think it is very important. I have some literature up here, and take anything that you'd like. There has been a fairly recent proposal called the Binding Triad, which recognizes that the present voting system in the General Assembly is uneven. It's like giving every representative in our House of Representatives an equal vote. Well, they do have equal votes, but no, that isn't quite right. Anyway, for a small country like Seychelles, which consists of tiny islands in the Indian Ocean, and has a total population of about 200,000, you know, smaller than Milwaukee, about the size of Madison. Imagine our getting a vote in the United Nations equivalent to that. Before that, I had a letter from Transkei, which is trying to upgrade, and they wanted to know whether a psychologist who's teaching at their brand new university could join the International Council of Psychologists. And he has. His first name is Quadragesimus, which I think is interesting. Anyway, the binding, you really do need to know about the binding triad, but it's a proposal that a vote can be binding if it's passed by three different votes. Two-thirds of all the voting members present in the General Assembly, two-thirds of all of the members representing two-thirds of the population, that is, a vote representing two-thirds of the population represented by those present, which is giving much larger weight to the large countries, and third, two-thirds of the monetary contributions made to the United Nations. So that you can quickly do a little arithmetic, the United States would be at something of a disadvantage population-wise because of India and China, would be at an advantage monetarily, and this seems to be a reasonably fair and just proposal.
I'd like to ask why President Eisenhower and Kennedy didn't go to the UN when it came time for the Vietnamese conflict?
That's a good question, and they... Yes, probably.
Because they couldn't have carried the majority.
They couldn't see China
from
here.
I
don't understand what...
They would have lost the war. They would have lost the vote in the United Nations. Nobody would have agreed that they were right, because they weren't.
I think we could spend all day debating some of these.
Why, yes. Eisenhower would go for the Korean approach that,
and for, yes, well, it's undoubtedly easier to call them in for a conflict that doesn't involve us so closely. Of course, the United States was very close to Britain and France and obviously didn't want Russia to support Egypt in the Suez Canal, but undoubtedly that was easier than this other. Anyway, I do urge you to take this, and while I'm mentioning what I have up here, there are some leaflets. There is a campaign for United Nations reform, which has joined forces with the World Federalist Association, which is an organization that has been working for world law and government for many years. The campaign for UN reform really seems very sensible and it's worth looking at. And then this is a record of the senators' votes on many issues, and as you can guess, Frogmar looks pretty good, Castor looks terrible, but you might be interested in the votes of the senators from your former home state and so on. Anyway, to mention the rest of the Congo briefly, throughout all of the difficulties there, Dag Hammarskjöld respected the rights of the government for independent action, but he also knew how to gather up political support. And there were many difficult situations between the Congo, the Congolese, and mercenary forces that were fighting in Katanga, for Katanga, this very rich province, but eventually it was brought back into Congo, which eventually became Zaire. And Dag Hammarskjöld himself was flying to a meeting in northern Rhodesia to meet with the leaders to make some settlement when he was killed in an airplane crash. And some people still, I think, feel suspicious that perhaps his plane was shot down. But I remember that event very clearly. My son was playing with boys in the neighborhood whose mother called me on the phone, and she had just heard from her husband, who was a retired Air Force colonel working in another job then. He had heard it over the radio, and it was so important to him that he'd called home and told her, and she wanted to tell me right away. It was regarded as a great loss for the world. And every now and then I think, what if Dag Hammarskjöld were alive today? I think things might be a little different, although one never knows. I just want to say a little bit about the Permanent World Court. Yes.
Excuse me. Is there a term for the President of the United Nations?
Well, he's the Secretary General. Yes.
I mean, is there a limited term?
Oh, he's appointed for 5 years, and that term can be renewed. Both the first, Trygve Lie, was appointed for a second term, but then he resigned in the middle of it when Dag Hammarskjöld was appointed, and Hammarskjöld had been appointed for a second 5-year term during which he was killed. On the back of this blue folder that's up there, it shows the pictures of all of them and the length they've served. I think most have served about several just 5-year terms. And I don't really know how they're selected, but obviously they are people of considerable reputation and regarded as very skilled. But he seemed to have special skills. Anyway, there certainly is some discussion of the International Court of Justice at The Hague now. It was founded in 1907, and even earlier than that, in 1899, the Tsar of Russia called an international meeting to discuss disarmament. At that point, he was concerned about the amount of money Russia was spending on arms, and they set up a permanent court of arbitration. And in the previous century, arbitration was the way nations settled disputes. And there were about 150 such disputes settled between countries. They would make a treaty with each other. One of the most famous is one that was between England and the United States at the time of the Civil War. Those of you who are watching Edward VII may remember that Prince Albert, you know, stayed up all night because England was upset at the actions of the United States in seizing one of their ships and taking Confederate officers off. And he realized that the very sharp note that the Prime Minister wanted to send could start war with the U.S. Well, an even more striking incident was that England, during the Civil War, permitted a ship to be built in one of its harbors for use by the Confederates. And it was armed and sent off, and it even was permitted to come back to port to get more supplies during the Civil War, which was certainly contrary to the actions that any neutral country should take. And this was a long dispute between England and the United States, but eventually they made a treaty to submit it to the Court of Justice to arbitration, in which five judges sat. And from their names, you can see they're Italian, Spanish, and so on. Anyway, the outcome of this arbitration between the two countries was that England paid the United States $15,500,000 in 1972 for abrogating the law of the sea, which is really impressive. I mean, $15 million then would be worth a lot more now. Pardon? I don't know. It probably went into the Treasury. Betty? I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. 1872. Oh, thank you. Maybe I wish it were. well, I think that's enough. I'm sure you have many comments and questions. Yes, Orange?
What's happening with UNESCO? We've heard a lot about the United States pulling out of support and the scandalous situation with the money being used by the administrators.
Well, it's still going strong. Dr. Elder here on the campus, a sociologist, is a representative to UNESCO, and I think he felt very strongly that we should not pull out. A French friend of mine who is in Paris wrote me and said she was glad that this country had, that she felt their leadership was extravagant and not particularly good. But UNESCO certainly has provided important services to many developing countries in encouraging literacy, increasing the literacy, and so on. I think it eventually will be solved, maybe not until the present director resigns, but it does have an important purpose. I really don't know more than that.
What is the relationship of the International Court of Justice to the General Assembly and the Security Council?
Well, it's an arm of the United Nations. Any country may present a case to it. I mean, it's available for use by the member countries. And as you know, the United States said recently, we won't regard any decision made regarding Nicaragua as pertinent to us. We'll disregard it. And there's no force to make them consider it. However, and they said it's political. Actually, there is a court of 15 judges who hear the cases. They're in permanent residence at The Hague, at the Peace Palace, which, by the way, was built by money given by Andrew Carnegie back in the early part of this century and is a very impressive building if you've ever seen it. But the International Court of Justice is not used very frequently now by nations, which is regrettable, I think. I think it's important for us to make clear to our president that we think the rule of law is important internationally as well as nationally. And by the way, in the early history of this country, there were many disputes between the states over boundaries. Even in, I think it was before 1800 was reached, some 2,000 Connecticut people from Connecticut who settled near Philadelphia were murdered by the Philadelphians, who didn't want outlanders in their territory, and so on. So we've come a long way in accepting, you know, the rule of law and the importance of states' rights. You know, the states still make many decisions independently of the national government. Yes, Les?
As I recall, the International Court of Justice is part of the United Nations. The charter says that the United Nations consists of the General Assembly, Security Council, some other councils, International Court of Justice. I mean, it's an integral member, part of the UN. But not all member nations recognize the International Court of Justice. It's a voluntary thing.
How are its members appointed? You know?
That I don't know. I have the complete charter here. It's a small booklet. Something else, which is a little unrelated, but yesterday at this terrific workshop that I attended, there was some talk about the importance of urging Congress to pass the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I mean, it's just one other step. And I have petitions. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom has quite a campaign on to get 5,000 signatures from every congressional district in this whole United States to send to the summit meeting to urge both the United States and Russia to agree on a comprehensive test ban. And I have several petitions here that if you are willing to sign, I think it may have a little impact. One never knows what will help and what won't. Yes? It's an appeal to the governments of member states of the United Nations, yes. Do you have doubt that France would agree to it?
Disagree to anything.
Well, the French are unusual. That's right. I think they still maybe feel offended because French was the international diplomatic language at one time, and it was replaced by English. And I think maybe they still feel that. I have to be very tactful in writing to my French friends. Yes.
The triad that you were talking about, is that three separate vaults, or do you look at one vault three
different ways? That I'm not absolutely sure.
I think I think it would be one vote, but it would be weighted three ways,
yes.
According to population, financial contribution, and one for destination.
That makes sense. I mean, it would be most confusing if a nation changed its mind when the population is being counted. That doesn't make sense.
Why should any country accept that idea? I mean, what's in it for the United States to adopt a voting procedure like that?
If you're crazy.
And what kind of thing is
it? It gives the United States and the Soviet Union a lot more clout.
It makes the vote of the General Assembly much more important and does weight to the larger countries.
From what I've read, one of the stipulations is that there would be no more veto in the Security Council. Countries that have it now be given in return for apparently, the greater security would result from the binding fire. Countries have to be persuaded that there's an advantage for them to give up their veto in exchange for this other thing.
That's right. You know, one comment that I heard yesterday that was very interesting was, what do you think is the most important alliance in the world today? You could guess, you know, what NATO, what... Anyway, this historian said, It's the alliance between the United States and the USSR not to have an atomic war. It's unspoken in a way, but and I think that's good food for thought. It's a little hope, anyway. Well, neither country, I think, wants an atomic war. Okay. Well, that's right. That's. No, it's to deter the other country. If that makes it even more stupid, that's right. We're throwing money away. It really is. It's a stupid, it's an anarchic social process that's going on. But if each country believes, and I think there's more and more evidence that people in this country believe, I mean, in a way, we may be indebted to President Reagan for talking so carelessly and openly about, oh yes, we can win a nuclear war, oh yes, we can have a limited nuclear war. And between 1980 and now, public opinion shifted. In 1980, about 20% of the people in this country said, no, we can't survive a nuclear war. Now about 80% in the polls say that, which is quite a shift. Yes, Jack?
And why that is not nonsense?
That is not nonsense.
But you have a pressure shift on the part of the people of both countries. And it's not, really should not be called nonsense, because there is a chance to stop it. I'm not talking about the government, I'm talking about people.
We probably shouldn't go on and on. It's five minutes after. I might read this little poem to you by G.K. Chesterton. I don't mean to trivialize or be frivolous about anything we've been saying. I really feel very strongly that we do need the United Nations, and we do need to develop ways for nations to solve their problems, and they're going to continue to have problems in dispute, but they can be solved peacefully. I think we have enough examples of that. But this is interesting. It's called The World State. Oh, how I love humanity with love so pure and Pringlish, and how I hate the horrid French who never will be English. The international idea, the largest and the clearest, is welding all the nations now, except the one that's nearest. This compromise has long been known, this scheme of partial pardons, in ethical societies and small suburban gardens, the villas and the chapels where I learned, with little labor, the way to love my fellow man and hate my next door neighbor.
Gee, the last time I was here, I made an announcement that we'd be using little cards for announcements, and now I have to face the music here. I'd like to remind everyone that we have a Prairie Board meeting here tomorrow night at 7:30. Everyone is welcome to attend. I'd also like to call your attention to our new organ. This was a donated item. We acted quickly in order to get it for the person who was leaving town. There's some other comments about whether or not we should have this organ. We'd all be willing to hear you tomorrow night if you'd be interested, or just pass the word to someone on the board. I enjoyed Mike's playing this morning when I came in, though. Fran says that we need some kitchen help. I volunteer, and I need one more person. I haven't done that in a while. Eileen asked me to read something saying that children, if your children are going to be taking UNICEF boxes, you can pick them up downstairs. It's a little better way to participate in trick-or-treat, and a little safer for them to do a good deed. It says that for a small amount of money, you do quite a lot of good, so I recommend that your children do it if possible. Dodie, in conjunction with that, says that she and Paul are inviting all Prairie trick-or-treaters to stop by. 239 Standish Court. Okay.
It doesn't apply dollars in UNICEF boxes. Pennies, maybe.
She'll have some of the sweet treats for them, I suppose. There are people that are new to me here. If they'd like to introduce themselves, I'd surely be happy to know who they are. Our friends of Prairie. Yes?
My parents, Gareth and Doshi, are visiting here from Ohio this weekend.
Welcome. Thanks for coming on such a nice day.
I'm Jeff Amundsen, my wife Jan Levin.
Welcome, Jeff.
I'm Steve Scott, and this is my wife Lori and my mother Dorothy. She's from Wausau, Wisconsin, and Lori and I just recently moved to Madison.
Oh, welcome. I hope you all feel welcome and come back, please. Shirley Grinrod has an announcement.
My announcement is kind of clashing with the meeting tomorrow night. There's a gathering, a service of welcome at St. Francis House for the sanctuary. They have a new person from Sanctuary, in Sanctuary, at St. Francis House. The welcome declaration for Jose will take place on Monday, October 28th at 7 p.m. at St. Francis House. The service is open to all. They would like all who are a part of the Sanctuary Covenant to come and bring a friend. And also, they are asking for clothing for the sanctuary person. Jose is 6 feet tall, weighs about 160 to 170 pounds, and he needs shoes or boots, size 10 and a half or 11, shirts, size 15, large, sweaters, large, pants, always difficult to fit. One could give a gift certificate or, better yet, take him shopping. Underwear, medium, 34 to 36 waist, new ones, please, socks, 10 to 13, winter jacket, a warm one. They don't think that he is aware yet of.
I think the rest of us have forgotten too.
Fortunately, you're with him every day in the state. Gloves, mittens, wool caps, and long underwear.
Okay, thank you. And you said something about Sauk Prairie on this card.
Yes. Today is it the, I can't remember what anniversary it is for them.
101
year for the Sauk Prairie Unitarian Fellowship with the Frag of Mind as they started out. What did I say, Sauk Prairie? I can't say Sauk without Annie, their sisters, I mean their next door neighbor, sorry. Sauk Cities. And they're meeting today, I think it's at 1 p.m.
1:30 for a tour, 4 o'clock is service, and 5 o'clock is dinner if you have previous reservations. But we didn't get word on it.
They would like some of us to come over to help them celebrate.
Jack, you had an announcement about Nukwatch?
I'd like to announce it by various people. The state of Missouri has 150 paddles, underground paddles with missiles in each, of course, aimed, you know, where. And each one of these missiles has an explosive force of 1.2 million TNT, each one capable of destroying the city the size of Milwaukee. The Kansas City Interfaith Peace Alliance is calling and sponsoring a weekend vigil at these paddles, a silent, peaceful, legal vigil, beginning leaving by bus here at 9 o'clock for night on November 9th, coming back late Sunday, late in the afternoon, I presume. Any questions that you have, there's a couple announcements there for those who can make it. The round trip ticket costs $35 and available from Nukwatch here.
Okay, thank you. Peg Stevenson asked me to read a couple of announcements. The Prairie Middle Schoolers are going to the play Who Says? It's on campus this afternoon. with Gail Osler and Peg Stevenson. Join them, if you'd like, at 1:45 at the Helmsley Theater, Vilas Hall. Many of you participated sections in the quilt at Upham Woods, beginning Wednesday evening at 7:30 here at Prairie. Join us, if you would like, to put together the Prairie quilt. So anyone is bring their needle and thread, sewing machines. Mary Mullen has a couple of announcements.
Two more things related to the sanctuary. The presentation at noon by a woman from Salvador talking about problems of Salvador and Guatemalan refugee women in Mexico. This will be 3 p.m. at the United Methodist Conference. And then next Sunday at 6 p.m. there's a benefit for the border support people. Benefits people just coming across our borders, refugees just coming across our borders. It's a potluck and $2 admission fee. 6 p.m. at Blue House, 310 South Ingersoll. I'll put this up there. There's new music, new games, as well as a potluck and a raffle of a handmade, handcrafted hammock.
And one last announcement. Carl Lang, who's our employee here, cleans up, has picked a bushel of apples for Prairie. They're out in the harvest table, under the table outside there. So help yourselves, please. Jack?
I did forget that out on the hallway there, and there are a couple items that were left up in wood. One of the yellow, black, raincoat type of thing, a belt filled with thing on the chair down there.
Okay. Thank you all.
I just have a brief thing to say that I didn't get in. Sorry.
Sure.
Anyone who missed hearing Seymour Melman last week on the economic impact of the military-industrial complex, we have an excellent tape of it, and you're free to borrow it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.